Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Sean Goldfinch. Sean holds a PhD in political science from the University of Melbourne and joined the School of International Studies last year from the University of Nottingham Business School in the UK.
Sean's published 6 books and over 50 refereed articles and chapters in different aspects of social science, including comparative public administration, policy, and international relations. He's held positions in the United Kingdom, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, the South Pacific, and the Middle East. I don't see any big gaps there.
That's like the whole world.
Almost the whole world.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Sorry, Antarctica.
North America?
I studied in North America.
Okay, good. So we've almost got the whole map.
I love the whole pause there as we actually kind of formulated maps in our head and figured out like where we are in the actual world.
I get lost inside this building, let alone in the world. Okay, but Sean has worked and consulted for governments all around the world.
Great, great. In 2023, Sean published the edited collection, A Handbook of Public Administration Reform, as part of the Elgar Handbooks in Public Administration and Management series. Derek.
Mary.
When we were like giving that overview, did you notice University of Nottingham, UK?
I did, but nubs.
Oh, yeah.
So this was a business school thing.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a nice connection there, but actually wrong floor here.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Do you think we should even be doing this then?
I don't know. I think because he works for us now, we can allow this.
We stole him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good scoop, by the way.
I agree. Hey, Sean.
Hi there.
I don't want to interrupt your conversations, by the way, so carry on.
No, please do. We're not going to ask you for a comparison of Nubs UK and FHSS.
Although we really would like to.
We'll save the dirt for a later occasion.
So, Derek, yep. Public administration reform. I hear you're an expert on this.
You heard wrong. Actually, interestingly, my father was a civil servant.
Is that true?
So he worked for the Ministry of Environment in Ontario in Canada.
Uh-huh.
So there's some
I'm
very
pleased
peripheral.
You said Ontario, Canada. As
well, I needed
to
double check. Not all of our listeners would know which country that might refer to. But it was quite fascinating to me because I didn't really understand at the beginning of the chapter what we were talking about. But then as I muddled my way through, I did realize. So at first I thought it was more of a political commentary. And I guess in some ways it is, and we'll ask
Sean
to
political.
Weigh in on this. But what we're talking about in terms of public administration is the, Sean, you correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but it's the embedded systems that kind of take care of the day-to-day of the government, right?
And not just the government, but also kind of all kinds of different organizations. So I think we were talking about companies too. That was the bit that I found the most interesting as regards kind of HR and companies as well, all of that. But I'm aware that I just actually interrupted the expert to tell him about his book. You know, so maybe we should actually let Sean speak. So Sean, please do give us an overview of your book.
I think the ground is somewhere in the middle. I mean, public administration really does take into account the legal and constitutional framework, which maybe distinguishes it from public management, which, funny enough, the position I had in NUPS in the UK. So it's a branch of political science, so it's inherently about the political framework as well. But it is about how government does manage the day-to-day as well. So it's not an either-or. But I think you need to take both of those factors is, I don't know if they're equally important, but they're both important. So the framework, but also how you manage within that framework.
Yeah, my mistake at first was thinking it was referring to the public. So the elected officials.
Oh, okay.
And that's actually, again, I don't necessarily have the even vocabulary, let alone near
well,
an expertise.
Well, they're still, you know, they're by no means not important, not unimportant, shall we say, given that they, particularly in Westminster systems, which is the British, Canadian, New Zealand, Australia, and parts of a lot of the rest of the world, actually, yes, the minister is responsible for the public administration of his or her agency. So, yes, they are key to this. But they're the sort of, I wouldn't say king, but the...
Wrong system.
the cherry on top of a very complex layer cake, perhaps.
Okay.
If that's not a really bizarre metaphor.
And so when we're talking about public administration reform, yes, which is the focus here, that tends to be driven top down. Is that?
It depends. Certainly, the chapter I wrote about New Zealand in the 80s and 90s, that was mainly driven by not only the public sector, the public service, but mainly one agency in the public service who weren't even necessarily responsible for that, you know, that area. But in Australia's case, often it's been politically driven. And then in Britain's case, I think it's a bit of both. And again, it just depends on the country. It depends on even the time frame. So right now in New Zealand, the public administration reform, which I point out is a very slippery term at best of times, that's been driven by a new government, I think.
That's
in
kind of
response to some changes they possibly didn't like from the previous government.
That's kind of what I was thinking of when I was reading this, because in our case in Canada, and I'm sure this is the case in a lot of these so-called liberal democracies, you get people running under the banner of reform or something like that. And I've always wondered how feasible that actually is, given how embedded these agencies and other organizations within the government might be.
It does happen. Mm. It's hard. And it's not necessarily the usual day-to-day business of things, but certainly it does happen. And it often happens in sort of almost there'll be periods of stability, decades sometimes, and then something will happen. And then it may be major, and it may – in New Zealand's case particularly, it was very much a very dramatic change because it was based on three pieces of legislation. And it was very comprehensive. Australia's case, it's been a little less big bang, but certainly significant. And again, in the UK's case, it's been a more meandering sort of process. In Canada, you also have the federal system. So that even complicates things even more. Mm-hmm. So you've got, the unitary states, New Zealand and UK, are probably easier for them to introduce reform. But Australia also, even at the state level, there were different trends and different directions. So, yes, it's complicated, and often it doesn't happen. But it's also, I think, reform is to some extent a job, if that makes sense. It just continues. It gives public servants something to do. You know, they're always reforming something. Whether or not that's a genuine change or not is another question.
What are the motivations for that?
Again, that's very contextual. So in the 80s, it really reflected a broader political movement, I think, which is, you know, Thatcherism in the UK, Reaganism a bit, although US was a bit later than this. In New Zealand, they called it Rogernomics. So it was a free market, smaller state model. So it borrowed some of the language and some of the economic theory from those broader reforms. But also, I think there was a general belief that, you know, things had reached a sort of stalemate a bit in the public sector. And that was reflected in a lot of writing, particularly out of the US, public choice theory particularly. And that really influenced a lot of this change, particularly in New Zealand, particularly in the UK. More recent changes, I suggest, are to do with again, public servants seem to like hiring other public servants and the state seems to get bigger. So I think that's certainly happening in New Zealand. There was in the 80s and 90s, they reduced the size of the public sector, but it's grown to, you know, again, it's probably larger. It's definitely larger, but even as a proportion of workers, it's probably got bigger. So there's a natural pendulum swing, I think.
Hmm.
You know, things don't work forever. They might work for a while. Sometimes they never really work, and they just continue for, you know, decades until someone has enough and actually does something about it.
The book actually deals with a lot of different states, though, right?
Mm. So
the latter part of the book, it goes through a number of different countries and a number of different systems, including one on China that you look at. So how do we compare something which could be the reform is driven by an electoral system versus other places where it may not be?
Well, you can draw on very similar ideas. What happens, particularly in public administration or public management, is diffusion of ideas. So the language gets picked up. Japan's a good example of that. Japan, where the public service is immensely powerful, to an extent probably more powerful than the politicians, they certainly adopted the language that they got from the UK, particularly of what is called new public management. And they did this a good 10, 15 years after everyone else had done it. And when everyone else had started, not everyone else, but the originators, New Zealand, Australia, New Zealand, UK, had started to sort of soften the language, Japan ran with it. But whether or not that was substantive reform is arguable. So the language changed, and to some extent the way they did things changed, but they maintained their, I call it rituals of reform in Japan. So that they maintained this, the public sector control over certain aspects, even if they changed the way they did it. And the language part was part of this reform game. You know, we're talking this new model, but really we're doing something else. So I think that's why people, because if you say I'm doing reform, it must be a good thing. You know, it's a statement it's an apple pie word, but it's used to slip in a lot of different things, or not slip in things, in fact, and to make sure things don't really change, or just change the label. So I think it's very contextual. So Japan, China's case, again, they adopted some of the language, and that's of new public management, but that's probably went out of favor again. The US, you had 50 states. They all did various different things. So there was a lot of talk and a lot of books, and you know, and particularly in the early 90s. But whether that made any fundamental difference, you know, is arguable, to be honest.
You do look at a huge amount of case studies, and it's actually really fascinating to hear you kind of sort of talk about some of those. And you mentioned this idea that some of them it's just kind of words in essence. What's the most kind of radical kind of case study in your book, do you think? What's the one that you think is actually the one that had the most impact, shall we say?
Probably New Zealand.
Oh.
Because, as I say, New Zealand in 1989, in the early 90s, really redesigned its state sector entirely. And it was all done by legislation, so it was done very quickly. That's pretty unusual. And that's been a very influential model. Whether it worked that well or not, you know, is another question, but it's certainly been influential. So I look at how they embedded this quite radical change. It was influenced by the British model, but they just took it further and they did it more quickly and they did it more comprehensively. And that's been quite influential around the world. That was influential in a lot of debate in the US in the 90s. And more recently, you know, supposedly it had died and we'd got rid of that in New Zealand, we being New Zealanders. But I just point out, no, they haven't. they've done some, in fact, they've revitalized some of the British aspects of the model. So I know that's a good example of you can have a radical change, but even if it's not necessarily perfect, it can be very influential, but too very sticky. You know, once you do that sort of changes, people don't necessarily throw out again. And, you know, it doesn't happen very often you do that. So Germany's a good example of that. Germany took on a lot of the language, of new public management. You know, the new public management really is, in essence, an attempt to apply private sector processes to the public sector. Whether or not they're genuine private sector processes, you can argue, to be honest, some of them. They're what economists tell us the private sector works like, which is not the same thing. Germany adopted a lot of the language of that, but really didn't do anything with it. So the German system is really, and Italy's another example. One of the chapters in the book talks about how you can trace a lot of the
I was interested in that chapter because it goes quite far back in history, actually.
Yes, and that, and same, making the exact same argument that over, you know, since unification of Italy, really the fundamentals, arguably, of the public sector haven't changed that much. There's been changes, but in a very sort of set direction, if that makes sense. It's like a railroad. You build the railroad, rail line, and you've always got that rail line. So you might change your trains a bit, but, you know, you're still on that line. And so that chapter is very good at pointing that out. Just once you set up the institutions, fundamental changes is unusual.
Mm. Well, one thing that's might be worth clarifying. So there's a traditional model. You talk about the three models, basically, and you go from a traditional model. So my understanding was stuck in the traditional model at first, but then once you started talking about this, what is the NPM, new public management model?
Yeah.
That's one that struck a chord with me because I saw that happening during some supposed public sector revolutions in our government, and especially at the provincial level in Canada. And then what you've just said about that also creates these echoes in my mind of what's happening maybe to the university sector, where you have an institution that has had these economic or business models imposed on it. But just to finish that, and then there's a post-NPM that you're talking about as well, right? So these are the three...
I'm a bit skeptical of post, if post new public management means anything except a sort of slogan. People try and say it's a whole new model. I'd say it's more or less sort of a collection of things.
Mm. Yeah, I only to sketch out, you know, what the chapter is dealing with. I guess, so my question is, you talk about the ways that these... models may or may not be perceived as, you know, you just talked about the train tracks and a linear progression, but there could be a better way to conceive of them as adopting the previous or else a hybrid model, right?
Sure.
So can you maybe expand
on
that?
The introductory chapter talks about we're a university, so I suppose I can use the word paradigm without sounding too pretentious. So how people perceive this as a paradigm shift. So you have one model gets replaced by another, gets replaced by another. But I'm not sure that's very, very useful way of looking at these things. And what you're saying is true. So the old traditional model, which is what we think of bureaucracy in the pejorative sense, which is rules, processes, and it shouldn't be taken as a pejorative. It's actually, you know, a very structure of modern society, you know, very much back to Max Weber describing this. That hasn't gone away. What happened is new public management came and layered over the top. And whether the debate is whether it's, are these sort of separate systems working together, or are they just, and the hybridization is more about, in fact, it's even more messy than that. So you have these almost competing models and not even models. To use the word model is probably overstating. They're like techniques and jargon and rhetoric, and sometimes they make no coherent sense, but people apply a post hoc coherency to them. So that's what they've done with, you know, when people talk about the new paradigm of post new public management or new public governance, or I mean, that to me is an attempt to impose order on something that doesn't necessarily have any inherent order to it. And Japan's a good example of that. New Zealand recently is a good example of that, where there's new techniques or new ways of doing things, but the old ways haven't gone away. They're still there. So you have a messy sort of system where even you could argue that the logic of new public management as it stood about 1994, for example, I mean, that's sort of been diluted by all these other layers of different things, but it's still there and working in some ways contradictory to other aspects of this. So I'm a bit of sort of... I think people impose a rationality or an order or a coherency on things that I don't necessarily see an order, coherency, or rationality. You know, I see things go, they might still work, and, you know, but despite themselves, if anything.
In linguistics, we joke in some of our work that humans are meaning making monkeys. And so we love to see patterns in stuff and create some sort of meaning, even when the pattern may be arbitrary or, well, I don't think I will dwell on the monkey part.
I think monkeys are great.
Monkeys are amazing. I agree. Yeah. So when I was reading through this as well, what I was thinking is, okay, so you have the traditional model that we all kind of think about in terms of bureaucracy. Then there's kind of a new model, new public administration, where you have an economic rationale put on top of this, or a business-like one. Is the idea behind the post-NPM that we're now entering into an information-driven sphere? Is that because you talk later on about big data and things like this, right?
I mean, there was an argument, in fact, that Dunleavy made this argument. He's at LSE, I think, that e-governance was a term he used. It killed off new public management, which I just think was a sort of nonsense argument, to be honest. I mean, it was it's just another management technique. You know, I mean, we still have government departments, we still have ministers, we still have chiefs of executives, we still have committees, but now they just happen to have computers as well. So So I don't think it's, I think it's changed things, but again, we could say it's layered perhaps, or, you know, so I don't think it's a new way of doing things, but not an entirely new way. I mean, we still have minutes, we still have meetings, we still have files, but now they're electronic ones.
And the information from a kind of big data social network scraping is not horribly far removed from a census or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Right? So I think people, particularly in the mid, maybe the first decade of the 2000s, there was going to be this radical transformation of government, and, you know, we'd get rid of departments, and everyone would work in cyberspace, and it just hasn't happened. Oh, I mean, to be honest, I miss the actual archives. It's much easier to walk into a filing room, pick up a file, than it is now to find them on the internet sometimes. So, you know, if you actually work for the agency I'm talking, maybe not for the outsiders, but yeah. So I think yes, it's been transformational, but not necessarily in the way that people perceived it maybe a decade ago or 15 years ago.
Yeah, I'm always curious about that. A change in scope, not kind.
Yes. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Looking at the volume, while you guys have been examining this, I'm still struck by, and this was the case when I first started looking at it, the diversity of the case studies within it. Sort of all of these different historical situations, different countries, exactly internationally. Why did you feel the need to create this book and bring these all together in this way? Was there a lack already existing within the literature?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of pragmatic reasons. Firstly, Joe Wallace and I did an edition in 2009. Mm-hmm. So it was probably, and it was a lot of work then, and I said I'd never do this again, you know, because I forgot that.
Oh, I've said that before, yeah.
Yeah. So they asked me the publisher wanted a new edition, and Joe didn't want to be involved. I've been writing about this area for a while. The last edition, you know, some of the issues were changed. Like you talked about big data, that, you know, that was a ethics never goes away. So there were some issues that we wanted to look at. Diversity probably wasn't a big deal, you know. I'm sure it was in 2009, but, you know, I can't remember there even being a chapter on it. So there were some things we wanted to talk about. Again, we want to put on Brazil, something on Brazil, something on Pacific, something on China. So, and again, a lot of the authors were new. So there was natural churn, not all of them, but, so it was just sort of time to do it, really. I mean, it's 2009, doesn't seem that long ago to me, but it really is quite a long time ago. So,
oh, that's one of those scary moments where you realize that 2009 was actually quite a long time ago now. And you're like, oh my goodness.
I just finished that yesterday.
Yeah. So it was a natural, and again, I mean, I did want to codify because I've been writing a few articles about this for a while. I did want to codify it, make it in a broader, you know, conversation around the world. And I think it's the audience is academics and probably postgraduate students, but particularly also practitioners themselves. So, that's the point of the series of their reference works. So you want something that stands alone on the shelf. You want to learn about public administration and where it is now. You go and get the book and it will give you a good, broad overview of topics and countries. It's not an encyclopedia, but it has aspects of that.
Going back to that diversity there, I even noticed that there's a chapter about the Pacific Islands as well, which I'm quite excited to read, actually.
Well, that's because I worked there. I could have written that chapter
but
myself.
But you've worked everywhere.
Yeah.
So
there's some former colleagues.
Sure. Was there anywhere in the world that you would have light to be covered that unfortunately you weren't able to get?
There was one, I'm not going to say where, there were a couple of chapters I rejected. Yes, there were at least two other countries that there were chapters produced, but I didn't use them. And there were a couple of people, there were a couple of countries I would have liked something on France. In the last edition, we had something on France. Some of the Scandinavian countries probably I would have liked to cover, but there's 23 chapters and, it's almost 500 pages long.
A point when you have to say,
enough's enough. Yeah. And you ask people and some people say yes, but don't deliver. Some people deliver and it's not good enough. And then some people just didn't want to do it anymore. So I think it was long enough, to be honest. It was a lot of work. As it stands at 23 chapters. So,
are there any kind of failed state examples?
You could argue about some South Pacific countries where they're failed states. I'd say they're fragile states rather than failed states.
I'm just curious.
I did look into actually having a bit more on failed states, but it's very hard to find people to write the chapters. And two, I think it would have diluted the focus a little bit. And I think that probably deserves a book in itself, to be honest, the nature of the public administration and state, failed or failing states. Actually looked at that myself, but not in this.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious because you do discuss New Zealand in this chapter and the way that it's often held up as an extremely non-corrupt version of public administration, particularly with the reforms, but that there are still elements within it that are a lot of gray area.
Yeah, and I think that's, that's, I'm a New Zealander, so I can probably say this. New Zealanders are a great country of myth makers, and they're always telling everyone else how wonderful they are. and there is a lot. And Britain's very similar. So in Britain or New Zealand, and I'd say Australia less so now, but certainly Australia 20 years ago, there were people, pushing suitcases of money across the table. That probably doesn't happen ever much in the UK or New Zealand. But there's other different types of, one of the chapters sort of calls soft corruption. So a lot of cronyism, a lot of, even nepotism and favoritism and all those sort of things, which are actually illegal in some common law systems. They're not illegal in New Zealand. So my take on New Zealand, if you define corruption in a narrow sense, it's very not, people don't, you can't get bribe your way anywhere. But there are other ways of, and I think New Zealanders are very complacent about that, as one of the chapters points out. And I think England's, the UK, but England particularly, very similar in that sense. How do you explain cabinets full of people who all went to the same school, let alone the same university? There's something weird going on there. Exactly. I think that's a very good point. And I'm sure Canada is much the same, to be honest.
I was very naive when I started traveling and when I was in places where misconduct of various sorts is normalized because I'm not going to reveal countries or situations, but I was asked once in order to get a visa to carry an envelope of gift money to give to embassy officials in order to rush my visa and make sure I could get it. And I was terrified. I had no idea. And I ended up not doing it because I just thought I can't possibly bribe an embassy official to get a visa. And then I was dumb enough to give it back to the person who had given it to me, who was in complete shock that not only did I not bribe someone, but then I didn't keep the money that I didn't bribe that person with.
But you're not doing this right, Derek.
I'm really not good at it, but I was naive.
Visa.
I got the visa anyway, yeah. So it wasn't,
The thing about corruption, it's actually illegal even when it's common. So it's one of those weird, people keep doing it even when it's illegal, and sometimes you don't actually, you can get away with not doing it. So it's, and it is illegal in international law, and many countries can prosecute you for it.
I couldn't imagine.
For bribing someone in another country, you can actually be prosecuted for.
Right, yeah. And that's the current system, actually. The British law is that anywhere you might be committing a corrupt act, you can be penalized for it in the UK.
Exactly.
But I'm just curious about systems from a public administration view, where this kind of misconduct is normalized. This is a butting up against systems. So in a globalized world, that's such a cliche, sorry, but the idea of institutions that are worldwide and trying to either do business or something worldwide, how do they deal with a public administration that won't necessarily function without the misconduct?
That's $1 billion question, isn't it? How you do business in these places. I think that you talked about failed states. I think that's one of the key indicators of a failed state is high levels of corruption. So it's very bad for the economy. It's bad for the people. If you look at foreign investment, particularly in oil and gas, having a failed state can make it encourage investment sometimes possibly for nefarious reasons, but, because you can go in there and take, build your plant. So, there are ways around it. You can just avoid it. But yes, it's corruption is really a leading driver of all sorts of things: warfare, civil war, poverty. So it's a pretty bad. I would say it was one of the worst indicators of underdevelopment. Probably the strongest.
Okay, interesting.
Looking at the chapters in the volume again, I mentioned before that the volume is significantly diverse and impressively so in terms of its the breadth of the world that it covers. But also looking at the various contributors themselves, I'm struck by the diversity of the disciplines that they actually come from. So, for instance, we have one who's a professor of biology, another one who's in health, obviously many that are in politics and international studies, but some also in kind of environmental science as well. So why do you think that this field in your field actually attracts people from this huge diversity in terms of their background and their discipline?
Well, government's important, isn't it? So if you're doing you're doing environmental policy, you're dealing with government. If you're doing ethics, you're probably dealing with government. If you're doing public health, you're dealing with, just public, not just government, but certainly a large chunk of health is public sector. So I just think government's such an important part of our lives. So if you pretty much study anything.
That must make it much easier to actually find contributors as well, because you can go sort of beyond your specific disciplines.
I didn't even look at their discipline so much as who they, whether they had some expertise, really. That was my main. There's someone who's a professor of accounting as well, Yamamoto. Professor Yamamoto and I have worked on and off together for quite a while. So he does, financial systems in the public sector. So it's a big field. It's a very Catholic discipline, public administration. We let everyone in.
So I'd be remiss in not asking, if it's public administration reform to drain the swamp and to complain about the deep state, to try to dismantle the deep state.
Where did this come from, Derek?
This is Trumpian rhetoric, obviously.
Well, that's the classic reform rhetoric, isn't it? It's about making the world a better place. So, yes, of course, yes, it is. Whether it's a genuine thing is another question, but certainly it would fit within my definition of public administration reform. I use it in a very neutral sense. I'm not saying it's good or bad. You know, some of it's probably very bad, some of it's probably good. Yes, I mean, why not? I have a chapter, next edition, we'll have a chapter on draining the swamp.
Well, and the rhetoric of the idea of the deep state or some sort of shadow government seems to be placing the elected official against the bureaucracy or against the people doing the administration work, right?
Well, I mean, that's a common theme through public administration for 150 years. Mm. I mean, that's one of the classic critiques of even of Habermas, of bureaucracies. People who talk about Weber often haven't read Marx's Weber. you know, that they are very powerful and they need to be kept in check. And I think that's true. I mean, whether or not that makes them a deep state. But I think we should be always a bit worried about how powerful government bureaucracies are.
It sounds like you've just been contracted for the next volume, Derek.
Well, I was very fascinated, actually, by Sean's arguments about rhetoric and discourse. So whether something is taking place in a kind of real world capacity or whether it's simply buzzwords or these type of things. So I think this does slightly get into a linguistic area in places.
Sean, I'm aware that we're aware that your volume has only recently been published.
Yeah, I literally got the hard copy yesterday.
I'm aware of that because you came and you gave me the hard copy. Thank you very much, which is very smart.
Online, it came out in November last year.
So because of that, I don't think there has yet been any kind of wider response, any reviews or any critique of the volume. But maybe building on that, is there any conversation that you hope has been started by this volume? What are the actual kind of repercussions and impact you would like it to have?
I mean, I would like to... It'd be interesting to see if anyone reads it in New Zealand. I know that partly because I'm a New Zealander, but partly because I wrote on New Zealand as well. Because that model is under the recent legislation in New Zealand will be challenged, I think. And, you know, and I'm not by any means a huge fan of it. I think there are good and bad aspects of it. But I think there is some complacency about the state of governments around the world. And my concern particularly is, and people have said this about Britain as well, as to the authors in this chapter, is the systematic undermining of technical expertise in the government. And I think that's been an ongoing thing for the last, you know, decade or two. Maybe that sounds elitist or maybe it sounds nostalgic, but being a public servant used to be a very difficult job and you had to, you know, you'd hire the best and brightest. And I'm not sure that's the case anymore. So I think it's partly lost its focus on technical expertise, which were, you know, which Max Weber talked about in a positive sense, and I think that's an issue. And so I would like that to be looked at in a bit more depth. I'm a great believer in technical expertise. I suppose I would say that because I'm an academic, but I think to run complex states, you need very intelligent, very well educated people, and I think government jobs, particularly in the West, used to be like that. And I think they've become more and more about hiring for other reasons, shall you say.
Are you basically referring to sort of populism by that, really?
Partly that. I mean, if you were talking about the US, I mean, that's always had a weird hybrid of a modern public service with a top layer of political appointments, which has worked, you know, well. Not perfectly, but well-ish. Whether or not that will continue to work well, I mean, because if the political appointments are genuinely incompetent, which some of them were and some of them are probably, I think that's problematic. So the US model maybe, I think, will start creaking even a bit more, particularly if there's another term of Trump. But I see, again, we talk about the complacency about levels of cronyism in some of these systems. Traditionally, the whole notion, it goes actually back to the Chinese Empire, can't remember which one, but they introduced exams, you know, to be a public servant. You had to be very, you know, so it was an elite thing. And I think that perhaps has been lost a bit.
Yeah, you mentioned merit, right, as a kind of core value.
Yes.
But then there's the open question of which merits.
Exactly. Know.
So if simply a political, ideological position is considered enough merit to get a position, that's a very different question than having the technical acumen to be able to do so.
And I'd actually read the recent New Zealand legislation allowing for that, which a bizarre definition of merit as someone suitable for the job, which is just entirely meaningless, and it could mean whatever you want it to mean. Again, but I mean, there is a downside to that. I mean, some, Japan being one example, some countries have very difficult exams that you take right at the start of your career, and that can set your life. So there are, or maybe that's the other extreme. And so I think we went from that extreme in a lot of the West to the other extreme where now I'm not sure how people get their jobs anymore. So maybe there's some
happy middle ground.
Exactly. Some rebalancing that could take place.
I know this is just one of the many projects that you have on the go. So we're always interested to know what the plans are in the kind of immediate future. So, I mean, this has just come out, but if you're going to do further work on this particular area, what would you be doing?
Well, I'm actually looking mainly at transparency at the moment, transparency and trust in government. So I looked at trust in government and privacy and transparency during the COVID period. So I just want to take the transparency a bit further than I did. So look at, you know, what it is about open government that does it make it more effective? Does it make it more trustworthy? Does it make it more ethical? So that's more a series of data sets, which I've published some of these things take a lot of time. So I've still got a few articles on the go on that. When that's done, I'm not sure really. Maybe I will finish a couple of other things I've been working on and off. I still haven't finished stuff on, I've written some stuff on Fiji, particularly where I lived for a while, that I'd like to go back to. And I'd like to finish some stuff on the Middle East that I haven't finished either. Mm-hmm. So I've got no shortage of projects. It's more shortage of energy and time, I think, is that.
Well, we could all do with a bit of that.
Yeah. And we do really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. Really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming.
Good food for thought.
And we wish you all the best in the future. Okay. Thank you very much, Sean.
Come back and talk to us again, please.
Okay.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.